today with a short wrap-up of transcription factors and development. Dr. Heitland talked about sexual differentiation and development, and she talked about transcription factors, but she didn't have time to do the last bit that puts it together. And this is on the bottom of 11A if you have it. If you don't, it's pretty simple to draw, or there are extra copies up here. Now, she talked about how the structure that is going to become the gonad, the genital ridge, is in fact bipotential. So you might say this is the bipotential pre-gonad. And it can go either way, developing either into a testis or into an ovary. And in the diagram, we've just actually shown primarily one of the two choices. Now, how does this all relate to transcription factors? In the gonad, pre-gonad in the genital ridge, it says on your handout that it has SF1. Now, this is a transcription factor, and this transcription factor is already on, meaning that the gene for this transcription factor is being transcribed, and this transcription factor is present in these cells. Now, if an individual is XX, that SF will go off. Other transcription factors will be turned on. They will turn on the genes needed to make the proteins characteristic of ovary. But if the individual is XY, then the master gene for testis is going to be turned on. And that is going to cause development in the other direction. And the gene that's responsible is the gene on the Y called SRY. This is for sex-determining region of the Y. And this gene codes for, again, for a transcription factor. Now, in Sertoli cells, this gene is turned on, making the appropriate transcription factor. Now, SF1 is already on, but SRY reinforces that. And the two together turn on another transcription factor called SOX9. All three of these are transcription factors. Now, what happens next is that SOX9 turns on the transcription of the gene that will make AMF, aka AMH, anti-malarian factor, and this influences the development of ducts. Now, in addition, these cells, using additional transcription factors, will also make a paracrine, which is not named here. And the paracrine is going to affect other cells, which will become Leydig cells. Now, what's interesting here is that we have two kinds of proteins. We have transcription factors that are in charge of what happens. We have transcription factors, and we have paracrines, or signal molecules. So what's the big deal? What's the difference? Where do transcription factors act? They're going to act inside the cell in which they're made to bind to regulatory regions, alter the state of chromatin, and cause cells, cause transcription to occur. So all of this is going to happen inside the Sertoli cell. But now, once we have turned on the genes to make the proteins for the paracrine and the AMF, are these transcription factors? These, in fact, are secreted proteins. They are signal molecules. They are going to be released from the cell, and they're going to bind to receptors on other cells and trigger some action in the receptor cells. So these are going to leave. They don't work on the cell in which they occur. They are secreted proteins that go out and affect somebody else. So they're going to bind to This paracrit, at least, is going to bind to Leydig cells and cause them, using the appropriate transcription factors, to turn on the genes to make the enzymes that make testosterone. Now, what's testosterone? Does it work inside the cell in which it's made, or does it work somewhere else? It actually works somewhere else. It also is a signal molecule. It's a hormone, an endocrine, meaning it is going to go into the blood and affect other cells. Now, the piece of this that we have not explained at all is we really haven't explained how a paracrine signal or an endocrine signal can cause something to happen in the target cell. That's the process called signaling, and we're going to talk about that in a few classes. In testosterone and the paracrine, as we're going to see, are going to act in very different ways, in part because testosterone is lipid-soluble, it's a steroid, and the paracrine is a protein. So one is water-soluble, one is lipid-soluble, and so when they get to their targets, their receptors are going to be in different places, and the response is going to be different, as we shall explain. So this is all I wanted to say about transcription, regulation of transcription as it relates to development. And I want to go on and consider some other aspects of gene regulation. So before I do that, are there any questions about this? Okay. Now, we have been focusing on the fact that if you have two different types of cells, like, say, Leydig cells and Sertoli cells, or you may remember those gruesome pictures from last time of the brain and the liver and the heart found in the backyard, that we have been discussing that different cell types and organs produce different messages and therefore different proteins. And this has an implication that, and we want to discuss what was this due to? Why did different cell types make different proteins? And largely we've concentrated on transcription, the idea that in each of these cell types, you have a different set of transcription factors, you transcribe different genes, you make different messages, and therefore different proteins. So if you were to make a DNA library from these cells, cut up the DNA with a restriction enzyme, clone the pieces, look at your collection, or you do it from these cells, how would they compare? DNA library. Not so sure. Would they be the same? Yes. Yeah, they would. But what if you make what is called a cDNA library? Now, you remember, cDNA is complementary DNA. It's what you get if you take messenger RNA and you take reverse transcriptase and additional enzymes, and using the RNA as a template, you make double-stranded DNA. You make first the complement of the message and then the complement of the complement, and you end up with double-stranded DNA, known as cDNA. Well, suppose I made a cDNA library. Suppose I took all the messages from here, made their cDNA equivalents, cloned those into bacteria, and got me a collection. And then I did it again with Sertoli cells. So there are two possibilities. That the two libraries would be exactly the same. That they would be totally different. Or they would be different, but there'd be some overlap. So which is it? So why don't you think about that for about 30 seconds, discuss it with your neighbor, and then we'll take a vote.
From Leydig cells.
discussion on this issue, so maybe it's worthwhile. I'm not going to make you close your eyes, but please stick to your guns. How many people think the cDNA libraries will be exactly the same? Nobody. How many thinks they'll be totally different? Nobody. Who thinks they'll be the same but overlapping? Well, I agree with you. So since everybody thinks the same thing, we're just going to proceed and not discuss it any further. And people use cDNA libraries, as you may imagine, to get some sense of what different cells are doing. Now, I want to turn this on its head and ask it another way. Suppose you have two cells, and you examine the same gene in both cells. Both cells transcribe that gene. The chromatin's in the same state for both genes. They both make RNA from the same gene. Do they have to end up with the same protein? Why not? You said no. Why not?
Alternative splicing.
And I want to broaden that to alternative processing. It's not just, as it turns out, there's not just splicing to consider, but also the addition of poly-A, caps, etc. So when we put it all together, just because you have the same RNA, you don't have to end up with exactly the same protein, although you are going to end up with a variant of the same protein. And I want to do an example of that, but I want to wait until we go through processing under the normal processing, and then we can see how you can vary it. So we've been talking here now about how does a cell, two cell types, make different proteins. The usual answer is difference in transcription, but there could also be difference in processing of the RNA. What if cells make more or less protein? One cell makes a lot, one cell makes a little. What's in charge of that? Well, it's worth thinking in comparison back to what gives with prokaryotes and how is it different in eukaryotes. So if we consider prokaryotes, we actually discussed operons and how this works. That in prokaryotes, you have the DNA, you open it up, and you transcribe some of it, and then what happens? Well, there's only one cell compartment. No nucleus, no cytoplasm, just one compartment. So as soon as the RNA is made, ribosomes start attaching to it. So there's no opportunity for processing. You make the RNA, and if you make it, it gets translated. There's relatively little, if any, regulation of translation per se. So there's automatic initiation of translation. What about the fate of this RNA? What about the half-life of this messenger? If you had to make a prediction, what would you say? Short. It's going to have, the mRNA is going to have a short lifetime. Now let's compare that to the situation in eukaryotes. Well, you have the same idea that you sort of open up the DNA and you make some RNA. But remember, this is in the nucleus. So now you have two separate compartments. The ribosomes are out here. So they don't attach right away. In fact, you peel off the RNA. So first you have transcription. But before, if you controlled transcription and the supply of message, that was basically it. But it's not it with eukaryotes. Because as we've explained, you can regulate processing. So you go from the so-called primary transcript to the actual messenger RNA. And this involves removing introns, adding poly-A, etc. And this process can be regulated in that it can have alternative paths, but it can also be regulated in the sense that you can do a more or less efficient job. So just transcription alone doesn't determine how much messenger RNA you get. There are two processes here that can be turned up or down. All right, so now you have your messenger RNA. What do you have to do next? You have to get it to the cytoplasm. So it has to go through one of those pores. It has to go out into the cytoplasm, so you have to transport. So you could regulate that too. You could make message and hold it up in the nucleus, or you could make message and ship it up right away. So in addition to transcription, we have here two additional steps that can be regulated to give you more or less cytoplasmic message. Now, once the message hits the cytoplasm, is translation automatic? And the answer is not necessarily. In eukaryotes, the step of translation per se itself is often regulated, not just by the supply of message. So that how often this message is used or how well it's read is now regulatable. So what are the two issues here? One is the issue of initiation. Will ribosomes attach readily or not? Initiation can be promoted or it can be blocked. But there's one other issue that determines how much protein we get out of this message, and that's how long it lasts. In prokaryotes, the half-life of virtually all messages is short. But in eukaryotes, it's very variable. Some messages sit around for a long time, and some messages are used once or twice and degraded. So degradation also can be promoted or inhibited. Now you can see if you get a lot of initiation and not too much degradation, what's going to happen? You're going to get a lot of the corresponding protein. But if you either degrade the message or block initiation, then you're going to get less protein. So we have here a whole bunch of steps that can be regulated. Now, it is correct that the primary point of regulation is transcription, just as it is in prokaryotes. But it's not the only point of transcription, and we know of many interesting cases where some other step is regulated. And today we're going to talk about a case of regulation of processing and a case or two of regulation of translation if we have time. Now, we don't want to forget something. In a eukaryote, or for that matter, in a prokaryote, if you make a protein, is there anything else to worry about? Is regulation of that protein done when you decide how much to make? Well, you've heard about an awful lot of proteins that are either activated or inhibited by some other event. Either they bind to a small molecule, like a co-repressor, an inducer, and that changes their shape, and they act differently. That's allosteric regulation. You've heard of proteins being modified by things like phosphorylation, which is reversible, or glycosylation, which is not. So also proteins can be modified and change their activity as a result of covalent changes. So there is post-translational regulation as well as everything else. Once the protein is made, its activity can be adjusted. Now these are two ways it can be adjusted. There are two more. We actually talked about one other one. Do you remember GLUT4? The thing that's critical about that is where you put the protein depends on whether it works or not. It can be in the plasma membrane and allow transport in and out of the cell, or it can be withdrawn into a vesicle, in which case it just lies around. So another way is by moving, we'll say, here we comes location, location, location again. Location is another way of regulating activity. And then there's a final one. We know that you can alter how much protein you get out of a message by altering degradation of the message. You can alter the half-life of a message. You can also alter or control the half-life of many proteins. Some proteins last a long time. Some proteins are degraded they're made, they do their thing, and they're degraded. They have a short half-life. So you can get rid of the protein you've made by targeted degradation. So the first three don't affect the amount of protein you have, just how well it works. But degradation means getting rid of what you have. A classic example of proteins that are used and degraded are the proteins called the cyclins. These are involved in regulation of the cell cycle, in the transition from G1 to S, for example, and from G2 to M. Both the proteins themselves and their messages have a short half-life. So you make the message, you make the protein, you use the protein to advance in the cell cycle, and then you degrade the lot, both the message and the protein. And we will talk more about this when we talk about the cell cycle. Now, this is a sort of overview of regulation that in eukaryotes, there's the issue of transcription, which we've largely discussed, processing, which we're going to, regulation and translation, which we're going to, and then regulation after translation, which we've already talked about, and we'll talk about more examples as we go. And what I want to do now is I want to talk about how this processing works and fill in the holes we left from last semester, and then consider a case where you can do it more than one way. So to review processing, we have handout 12A. Now, I assume you remember, or you know, that genes contain both exons and introns. And so we've drawn a simple gene here. And to keep it as simple as possible, it has one intron and two exons. Now, there's an arrow here to symbol the start of transcription, as we discussed before. So where's the core promoter? The core promoter is going to be over here, the core basal promoter. There'll be additional regulatory elements here, and perhaps distal ones up that way or down further. Now, once all the right transcription factors, polymerase, etc., bind, and you get transcription, so we've drawn the picture sort of the way we did before, then here's the RNA. I'll make it darker. So here's the 5', 3' end, and the RNA is growing this way. Now, as we explained last time, this intervening sequence will not appear in the messenger RNA. But we're going to transcribe the whole thing and then splice out the intron. But as soon as the 5' end is available and free, we're going to put what is called a cap on the end of it, which is thought to block degradation and to assist perhaps in the attachment of ribosomes, so it promotes translation. And the cap is actually a G, a nucleotide with G, added backwards. So the very 5' end of RNA still has a triphosphate on it, whatever it happens to be. The G has a triphosphate. So these are both nucleotide triphosphates. But usually they don't add this one. Usually each one is turned around. But in this case, they go phosphate to phosphate end, and this is removed. These three phosphates are removed, so we break two phosphodiester bonds, and you end up with a connection of G with PPP, first nucleotide. Now, the point is, this means that the phosphate end isn't sort of floating loose. There's something on the back end which is protecting the 5' end. So this final structure is called a cap. If you're interested in the details either of the structure or the mechanism, it's in all of your books and in more advanced texts. Now, transcription continues. So that was step two, we just did. We just did one and two. And now in step three on your handout, transcription continues. Now, in prokaryotes, there is some kind of termination signal which causes the polymerase to stop and to fall off the DNA and release the RNA. In eukaryotes, it's thought that RNA polymerase doesn't have a real signal. RNA polymerase continues past what would be the normal end of the message. But there is another enzyme that recognizes where the end of the message ought to be. And in step 4, that enzyme comes along and it cuts off the end of the it cuts at the end where the 3' end is supposed to be. And this little bit here will get degraded and the RNA polymerase will fall off. What is the symbol to cut here? If you look at your handout, you see that there's a sequence a little upstream of it, meaning going 5 prime to 3 prime, which is AAU triple A. And that sequence means end soon. So the end is somewhere between 10 usually and 35 nucleotides down the road. So this distance varies, but it's short. It's 10 to 35 nucleotides. Now, the enzyme complex that cuts off the end of the RNA, the extra stuff, has several proteins in it. And one of the proteins cuts the RNA, and another protein adds the so-called poly-A tail. So we've drawn here 2 steps. In 4, we had the cut. And then in 5, we had the addition of poly-A. And these are probably simultaneous by 2 parts of the same complex. So now we have the cap, we have the message, and now we have a chain of A's on the end. Several hundred, usually, nucleotides long. Now, most, but not all eukaryotic messages have this tail of A's. And it's very useful in the laboratory for helping you to fish out messages. Its actual function is not entirely clear, but it may help, again, prevent degradation from this end. It may help transport out of the nucleus. And it may have other uses. Now, according to this, your diagram, again, the cut occurs first and then the addition of poly-A, but they're probably simultaneous. Now, another feature about this that's important is what coded for this G? Was there a C in the DNA? And the answer is no. What coded for these A's? There's no T's in the DNA. So there's no template for this. There's just an enzyme that adds A and then A and then A and then A over and over and over again. And this is called a poly-A tail, usually. Now, this is sort of the fixing the two ends part, but this doesn't say anything about splicing. And the rest of the handout is about how splicing occurs. Now, the way the handout is written, first you do the cap and the poly-A, get it all adjusted. And then you'll notice in the next picture, all I did was to add back these 2 blocks to show that this is where the exons are relative to the intron. And now we're going to splice out the intron. Now, we discussed how splicing works last semester, and I'm going to very briefly go over some of it, but it's in more detail in your notes for reference if you either don't remember or never learned it. But the important point here is that it's not really true that you do all the poly-A cap and then you do the splice. Probably that also is happening at the same time. Now remember that many transcripts are very, very long. So that splicing probably starts before you get to the poly-A cut part. Similarly, we think there are cases where adding poly-A occurs before certain splices. That, in fact, is the example we're going to discuss. But let's just briefly talk about the splicing part. In 6, all I've done is relabel it so that you can tell the 2 exons from the intron. Now, this stage is usually called the primary transcript. But as we've mentioned, it may not exist because by the time you get this far, you might have started the splicing already. Now, how does splicing work? We're going to join the end of the first exon to the beginning of the next. And these are labeled from the point of view of the intron, so this is called the 5' end and the 3' end. But it's also thought about sort of from the exon's point of view. This is the donor end of what is going to be the joint, and this is the acceptor end of what's going to be the joint. And as diagrammed on your handout, you're going to cut first at the 5' end, then at the 3' end, join the two exons together, and release the middle as a lariat and degrade it. And all of the process of splicing is carried out by the spliceosome. As its name suggests, like a ribosome, this thing is large and contains both RNA and protein, many of each. And the RNA protein complex, or ribonucleoprotein, or ribonucleoprotein particle, is responsible for all of the steps of splicing. And one of the reasons I bring this up is today we're going to meet another RNP, we're going to meet another complex which does something important. So this is the basic scheme of processing. And all of it is probably happening more or less at the same time. And one of the ways we know that is from the example I want to talk about. And that's on 12B. Now, processing can be regulated to be more or less efficient, so you get more or less message at the end. But it also can be done in more than one way, as we've indicated, so that you can get more than one possible protein out of the original primary transcript. Now, the examples we talked about last semester involved exon skipping. That gene has only one intron, but you can conceive of a gene, exon 1, exon 2, exon 3. Poly A transcription starts here, message stops here, and we add the poly A. Now, you can join this donor to this acceptor, and this donor to this acceptor, which is usually symbolized that way, and get a message that has all three exons in it. But what we meant by exon skipping is you can also join the first donor to the last acceptor. And if you do that, the middle exon becomes part of a super intron. And we actually end up with a message that has only two exons corresponding to the first and the third. Now, this is a simple example of alternate processing that you can join different acceptors, donors to different acceptors. It turns out that you can also sometimes start transcription in more than one place. There's sometimes choices. And you can end transcription by the addition of poly A in more than one place. And the example I want to talk about involves that possibility. And so if you look at the top, we have the end of the gene with the last three exons. Now, in a way, this is easier to explain if we start at the bottom. This is an example of the production of antibodies. And it turns out that you can produce two different types of antibody with the same antigen binding or grabber site. And you do that at different times of development of the immune system. That if you look on the right, what has happened is you've made an antibody that has a hydrophobic tail. Now, because there's a hydrophobic patch in the back end of the antibody is actually lodged in the membrane. So the antibody, when it gets to the surface of the cell, is sitting on the surface. Another alternative, by alternative processing, one can make a different version of the same antibody in which all the front part, the antigen binding part, is the same, but the hydrophobic tail is missing. And if there's no hydrophobic tail, then the protein actually is released entirely from the cell and ends up in the blood. Now, how is that possible from alternative splicing? Well, you remember when things enter the ER, if you go back in your picture up to the ER, and this is the ER, surrounded by, this is a bilayer, this is a bilayer, that we haven't gone into the details, although I hope we'll get to it today, but when ribosomes are making proteins destined for the endomembrane system or the cell membrane, those ribosomes attach to the ER and they start making their protein. Now, in a case like this, as the protein is made, it wiggles into the ER. It goes through a pore in the ER membrane, as we will explain, and the entire protein ends up inside the ER. So when a vesicle forms off the ER by budding, that vesicle will contain the protein. This vesicle will fuse with the Golgi, and then vesicles will bud off the Golgi. But every time you make a vesicle, this protein is going to be completely inside. And when this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, its contents are going to be delivered to the outside. Now, what if, when we make the protein, it has a little hydrophobic tail? Then the protein starts to wiggle through, but it gets stuck in the membrane. And so, instead of being in the lumen of the ER, it's in the membrane of the ER. So when a vesicle buds off, the protein is going to be sitting in the membrane of the vesicle. And when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, the protein is going to end up on the surface of the cell and not released. Now, before we go any further, what do you need to do this for? It turns out that this protein formation, the surface protein, is used to trap antigen. How do you know you've been exposed to an antigen? The antigen comes by, it binds to this protein acting as a receptor, and that triggers events inside the cell. And the cell actually switches to doing the opposite. Now the cell knows that's the antigen, so to speak, and now the cell will start secreting or releasing molecules that have the same grabber end, the same antigen specificity. And these proteins will go through the blood and mop up the antigen. So what happens in response to the right antigen signal is the cells go from doing it this way to doing it that way. So how do you do that with alternate splicing? So you go back and you look here at what's going on. And as you can see here, there's a poly-A addition site actually in the intron between exons 4 and 5. And there's one in exon 6 at the very end. So you could add poly-A either way. Now, these two exons, 5 and 6, code for a stretch of amino acids that includes a hydrophobic section. So if you make the protein set stretches corresponding to 5 and 6, the protein will have a hydrophobic tail, stick in the ER, and end up on the cell surface. If you don't make proteins corresponding to 5 and 6, if you leave that part off, the amino acid sequence will end with 4. The protein will be all soluble, go all the way into the ER, and end up on the outside. So the trick is, who gets there first? The poly-A adding complex or the spliceosome? And these two are written here as possibilities. So you end up, consider a primary transcript that has the whole shebang or that has part of it. If the poly-A ending enzymes, poly-A adding and message cutting enzymes get there first, they're sort of working their way down, and they get to here. That's where you cut poly-A. That's where you cut the primary transcript and add poly-A. So you will add poly-A at the end of 4. So you'll have exons 1 through 4, and then you'll have poly-A. You'll never get to the rest of the message. But suppose the splicing machinery gets there first. If the splicing machinery gets there first, it will cut out intron 4, eliminating the add poly-A here, cut here symbol. And since that signal is gone, what will happen is you will join exon 4 to 5, 5 to 6, and add poly-A at the end of 6. So now you get something that has exons 1 through 6, and then poly-A. And that codes for the version with the hydrophobic tail. Now, there are many other similar cases known, but this is one of the most dramatic, where by using a different spot to add poly-A and thereby eliminating or including certain exons, you either get a soluble version of the protein or a membrane-bound version of the same protein. And this is very important in antibody function in your body. Now, if you're using antibodies as a lab tool, which kind do you want? You want the soluble ones. But from the point of view of your immune system finding antigen, it first has to have this kind, the surface kind. Now, yeah.
So just about this, you said once the antibody that is in the membrane binds to an antigen and then it signals to produce the other kind, how does it make sure that it makes the other kind and not the one with the hydrophobic section?
The question is, how does the cell switch from this section to this section? It means that there must be a change in where the poly-A is added. So there must be a change in whether the poly-A adding machinery or the spliceosome gets there first. And how that is done, I don't think anybody knows. What controls alternate splicing is a subject that people are very much interested in and trying to work on, but at the moment, I don't think anybody knows the answer. Yes?
The enzyme that cleaves off the extra bit there, or uh-huh. stuff, what cleaves off that coding for that enzyme if that doesn't exist yet? Does that make sense?
No.
So if you have to...
I think what he's got at is that to do anything, you need pre-existing enzymes. So where do they come from?
Right.
Remember that cells come today only from other cells. And when a cell divides, all the things that were in that cell, a little of each is in the daughter cells. Now, if you get nothing, no ribosomes, you're dead. But if you get a few too many or a few too little, it doesn't make any difference. Yeah? Is there competition between every exon? No, because there's no poly-A addition site possibility here. It's only this one. This is the only point at which there is competition in this system. And probably in most, there isn't. Yeah?
How does the protein go from the ribosome into the ER?
How does the protein go from the ribosome to the ER? Well, hopefully we'll get to that today, and if not, we'll do it next time. Okay.
The enzyme that triggers the poly-A addition, that is not triggered by the cleave here marker sequence that you discussed.
The question is, this sequence, how is this sequence related to this spot? They are related, and the enzyme complex recognizes this and sets to work some distance down. But how it decides exactly where it's going to hit, I don't know. Yeah.
So, when it wriggles into the ER as it's being made, is it going to the core?
Her question really is about how you get the protein into the ER, and I apologize again, but we haven't told you. And hopefully we'll get to it. Okay? Not this time, next time. But if it doesn't make sense yet, it's okay. Okay. So I want to leave this issue of processing and regulation of processing and consider the next step in our scheme here, which I hope I didn't erase. I think it's under here. Yeah. So we said that not only can you regulate transcription and processing and transport, but you can also regulate translation itself. And I want to talk briefly about two examples of regulation at transcription, I mean at translation itself. Now, these are two famous examples. One involves iron metabolism and one hemoglobin production. Now, I'm not going to do all the details because it's the overview here, the principle that counts. In the case that we're talking about, one of them involves only alternating, only regulating initiation, and the other one involves controlling both initiation and degradation. In the case of iron metabolism, there are actually two very important proteins in the cell that control how much iron is available. And iron is needed as cofactors for many enzymes. And one of them is ferritin, and one of them is the transferrin receptor. Now, we've already talked about the transferrin receptor and its role in trapping transferrin and bringing iron out of the circulation into the cell. Ferritin, on the other hand, is the protein that stores excess iron. Now, you can see that if the cell already has a lot of iron, it makes sense to cut down on transferrin receptor because you don't want to take in any more iron. And it makes sense to up the ferritin so you can store the extra iron. It acts like a storage or a sponge. On the other hand, if there's not enough iron, the sensible thing to do is to make more transferrin receptor so you can take it up, and less ferritin so you don't soak up what's there. Now, in this case, the system works very much like repression, in that you have a regulatory protein that binds to a cis-acting site. But the big difference is that the regulatory protein does not bind to DNA. It binds to RNA. So the regulatory protein is acting sort of like a repressor, but it binds to messenger RNA, not DNA. So it doesn't affect transcription at all. It affects translation. Now, remember, in prokaryotes, you have polycistronic message, but in eukaryotes, you have individual monocistronic messages, one message for each peptide. So there are two separate messages, one for ferritin and one for transferrin receptor. Now, what happens is that the same sequence is found in both of them. I want to make the labeling match your notes. That's why I'm looking it up. So the one I'll call A, the message I'll call A, has a sequence right here, which would be a cis-acting sequence. And the same sequence is found then at the 5' end of message A and the 3' end of message B. And the protein, the regulatory protein, can bind to both of these. And the regulatory protein has two forms, just like an allosteric, any other allosteric protein, like a repressor protein. And what interconverts them is iron. And the way it works is that the form that binds is without iron. So this is no iron, and this is with iron. So if there is no iron, what happens is the protein binds to both of them. And if there is iron, the protein's in the other shape and it doesn't bind to either one. Now, one of these is the messenger RNA for transferrin receptor. One of them is the message for ferritin. And I'm not going to tell you which is which. You can figure that out. And there is a link in your notes to where the answer is. But what's the idea here? What's the point? If the protein binds here, that will affect initiation. That will affect attachment of ribosomes and getting translation started. So if the protein binds here, will you get more or less of the corresponding protein? If the regulatory protein binds here, will you get more or less of the protein made from message A? You're going to get less. On the other hand, the same protein binds the 3' end of the other message. Notice this is an example of coordinate control because the same regulatory protein is responding to the supply of iron and affecting both messages simultaneously. But what happens if protein binds, the regulatory protein, binds to the cis-acting site on message B? Are you going to get more protein B or less? When you bind to the 3' end, you're thought to block degradation. So if you bind to the 5' end, you block initiation, less protein A. If you bind to the 3' end, you block degradation, more protein B, less protein B. Now you're going to get more protein B because the message isn't going to get degraded. It's going to stick around longer, and you're going to make more protein B.
I just want to make sure I understand. It's one, only one is binding to each one. You don't have
these two messages, the question is what's sticking to what? These two messages are separate, but you have many copies of the regulator protein. So some copies are sticking here, and some are sticking here. So the regulatory protein here is a trans-acting factor of which there are many copies, and it can act on either one. Okay, so you take them off, you take the regulatory protein molecules off, you're going to get more initiation and more protein from A and more degradation and less protein from B. So the only thing I haven't told you is which of these is the message for ferritin and which is the message for transferrin receptor, and I'm going to leave that for you to try. And other than that, as to which is which, are there any questions about this? Yeah?
So is thalassemia affected? Is this exactly what affects
This is not thalassemia. I think you're thinking of hemochromatosis.
It's where your body can't shed.
Can't shed iron. That's a different disease. Thalassemia is when the alpha and beta chains of hemoglobin are out of balance. But there is a case where you can't shed iron. And I don't know if it's related to this or not.
Okay.
I suspect it's a different protein, but I don't know. Yeah. But there are cases where you have too much iron. You can't get rid of it naturally. And they have to give you transfusions to remove your blood with the iron bound to hemoglobin and replace it. Speaking of which, the other case I want to talk about involves translation of the message for globin, and that's where my t-shirt comes in. Red blood cells don't have DNA, but their precursors, the reticulocytes, do. And they make globin. Globin is the protein part of hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is the protein globin with heme attached. This is heme. Heme is a small molecule compared to a protein, although it's complicated compared to glucose. So your cells make heme by a standard pathway involving enzymes. And they also make this protein called globin. But the two processes have to be coordinated. Heme is no good without globin, and globin is no good without heme. So it turns out that heme stimulates the translation of message for globin. So this is another one of those cases where the regulation is not at transcription, but in fact it's at translation. Now, the heme itself binds to other proteins which affect translation. Now, what is so interesting about this case is that heme inhibits an inhibitor. So there's a protein here that blocks translation in the absence of heme. Heme combines with a protein, puts it out of commission, and now you can get translation. This is an important example because what happens if you inhibit an inhibitor? You get stimulation. This is like algebra, you know, minus times minus is a plus. So some things that overall stimulate do it by activating. Some stimulate by getting rid of the inhibitors or inhibiting the inhibition. And that's the case that we have here. Now, there are many other examples like this, but these are two of the most famous. Now, I want to say one other thing. We're talking here about the idea, both with transcription, with translation, with regulation, that you have these cis sites on the DNA or the RNA, and you have proteins that sit on them, and they either stimulate or inhibit. But the transacting factors in regulation don't always have to be protein. They can sometimes be small RNAs. And I think we talked last semester about the phenomenon known as RNAi or RNA interference. When this phenomenon was discovered, that adding small RNAs interferes with translation, it was called RNAi. Now, RNAi was originally discovered because adding small RNAs can block translation in some cases. The RNA, either directly or indirectly, generates an anti-message, a short piece that is the complement of the message. The short piece combines to the message and leads either to the blockage of translation or the degradation of the message. And we now know that short RNAs can also, under some circumstances, activate messages, and they can also affect transcription as well as translation. Now, this is a very active area of research at this moment. The question of what is the natural role of small RNAs in regulating the operation of cells? This is also a very important issue in the laboratory because people have been able to use these short RNAs to knock out the messages one at a time for each gene. This has been done extensively in simple organisms. Rather than using mutations, people have added this short antisense message, essentially, to knock out one gene at a time and see what happens. So this is a sort of new area which is just now getting discovered, and people keep finding more and more small RNAs with more and more interesting roles. And this is one of those examples where RNA is beginning to have more functions in the cell than just the handmaiden of making proteins. Although you could say that being a regulator is really about regulating the proteins that are made, and that's really the end product of all this. Now, I should mention that people have been trying to use RNAi phenomenon to develop drugs that would turn off overactive genes that are causing trouble, and that some of these cases have actually come close to commercial use, but many of them have not. It's turned out, as always with miracle drugs, to be harder to get them to work in large numbers of people safely than to get them to work in the lab or in rats. Now, I want to stop talking about regulation now and talk about this question that I hope I have made you curious about, which is how do the proteins get into the ER or into the ER membrane? How does all of that work? So before I do that, let me ask if there are questions, any questions about this regulation business. Yeah.
With post-op prokaryota, is that what's going on there? The heme group is
doing what?
Prokaryotes, they can't make heme groups.
In porphyria, you can't make heme properly. And there are many results from that. One of them is this problem, and that it interferes with the production of globin. The biggest problem with porphyria is that since you can't make heme, the precursors in the synthesis of heme build up, and they are toxic. So it's not so much the lack of heme as the overproduction of the things that should have been made into heme that is really the problem. For anybody who has seen The Madness of King George, that movie is about the story of King George is thought to have had porphyria. Okay. So now we want to switch gears a little and discuss how do proteins that are being made that belong in the ER get to the ER. So for this you want 12C. In higher eukaryotes, proteins that are going to end up in the ER or the ER membrane enter co-translationally as they are made. And we discussed this once before. But now we want to look more carefully at the details of how it works. Now, suppose you have a messenger RNA, it arrives in the cytoplasm. There are no inhibitors, it doesn't get degraded. And ribosomes attach, that is, the two subunits come together, and they start making protein. What is going to determine whether this protein enters the ER or not? Well, that's going to be determined by a localization signal on the protein itself. There's something in the sequence of the protein itself that essentially says, take me to the ER. So ribosomes, all ribosomes are the same. They start making message, and it's the protein, and it's the character of that protein that determines what happens next. So we've written here in step one that here we have a growing chain, which is called a nascent chain. And up here would be its amino end. Now, it isn't shown on this handout, but if there are two possibilities here, and only one of them is shown. In here somewhere may be the special localization signal that says, take me to the ER. And that is usually called a signal peptide. It is usually a stretch of amino acids. It can be at the very end, or it can be further down, as we will explain. For this case, we'll leave it on the end because that's the simplest case. Now, if there is no signal peptide, if no sequence there, if this sequence is missing, then what will happen? We'll just keep making this protein. The ribosome will go down, we'll make the protein, we'll release the protein into the cytoplasm. So no SP, you get a cytoplasmic protein. This has many possible fates. It can, depending on what signals, if it has no signals at all, it'll stay in the cytoplasm. If it has a nuclear localization signal, it'll go to the nucleus. If it has a mitochondrial localization, it'll go to the mitochondrion, etc. We'll come back to all that. But if this sequence contains a signal peptide, then what happens is it binds what is called the signal recognition particle. Now, this is called, the whole thing is called the signal hypothesis. The idea that there is a signal in the protein itself that says, take me to the ER. But the only way that works is if this signal is recognized by and binds to not a protein, but a ribonucleoprotein complex or particle called the signal recognition particle. And that's symbolized on your hand by a triangle. Now, what good does that do? First of all, this stops translation temporarily. So that will give time for this message, ribosome, et cetera, to move over to the ER, nestle up to the ER, and then this protein can start entering the ER as the rest of it is made. So one thing that the SRP binding does is to cause a temporary block in translation. But there's another issue here. This may say, take me to the ER, but this doesn't stick to the ER. How is this sequence going to cause the ribosome to hold on to the ER? And here, that's what we need the SRP for. The SRP is a middleman. It's going to bind to the signal peptide, and then it's also going to bind to the surface of the ER. And once it's made the match, it's going to get lost. Now, you've met another case like this. You could say that importin and exportin act in a similar sort of way, that you have something that has a nuclear localization or a nuclear exit signal, but that doesn't allow it to bind to pores. The exit or entry signal to the nucleus allows it to bind to importin or exportin, which allows it to bind to the pore and to the proteins that stimulate in or out. So this is a similar sort of middleman job. The SRP is the middleman. So the whole complex now goes to the ER. Now, what we've drawn here is really just a bilayer. This is not the lumen of the ER. This is the lumen of the ER. And here's the bilayer, which is drawn on your handout. And what's in this bilayer? Now, the actual picture that's drawn in your handout is of the way we've drawn it here. It's the bottom bilayer in that you could draw it this way. This is facing the outside or the cytoplasm. This is facing the inside of the lumen. So there's a protein which faces the cytoplasm, which has a binding site for the signal recognition particle. These two are going to match up. So the signal recognition particle allows the ribosome and the message to get together. Now, this doesn't do anything to get the protein into the ER. To get the protein into the ER, we have to have some sort of pore with a water-filled environment that the protein can go through as it's made. So that's why there's this other structure here. This is the actual pore or translocum. Now, as it says in your notes, some people use the term translocon just for the pore. Some people use it for the whole shebang. The pore and the protein next to the pore that binds the signal recognition particle. It depends on the context, and it's usually obvious what is meant. Now, this gets us ready to roll, but it doesn't do anything. We now, remember I said when the signal recognition particle gets everything in shape, it gets lost. So in the next step, which is step 4, this is quite complicated and has many subdivisions. But basically what is going to happen is the signal recognition particle is going to hand off the protein to the translocon. And it is going to come off. Now, one thing we didn't say is what people call this protein. What would you call it? Well, one way to call it is it's the receptor for the signal recognition particle, and it's called that. It's called this SRP receptor. But some people like a more colloquial name, and they call it the docking protein. But it means the same thing. It's the protein to which the SRP, ribosome, nascent peptide, etc., all get stuck. And now there's a handoff from the docking protein to the translocon itself. And so at the end of step 4, and I'm going to draw that over here, What we have now, so this is the lumen up here. This is the membrane. The docking protein has let go of the SRP. So the signal recognition particle is released, and it can go around and find another nascent chain on a new message in ribosome and ferry them over. It's recycled. And now the protein is going to start going through the translocon. Now, if you look over in your previous picture, you see that I filled this in solid. Things don't just leak out through the pore, and things don't leak in through the pore. So there's some kind of gate on the pore that until the protein starts going through, stays closed. But once the protein, as it's made, starts going through the pore, that opens somehow. So if there's a gate, it's open. Now, in your picture, there is a space between the ribosome and the translocon. There really is no space. So the ribosome is right up against the bottom, and therefore, this passage is sealed so that the protein can move through, but nothing else can leak in or out. Now, this process, step four, involves quite a lot. It means releasing the signal recognition particle, moving the protein over to the translocon and starting it to go through, and open. So you both open the pore, bind the ribosome, start the protein, and we had to split GTP. We didn't go into the details. You can look it up if you like, but it's required. Now let's just finish this basic process. And the thing to notice here is you notice the protein didn't wiggle through like this. It made a loop, and the loop went through. And as you'll see, that's very important, especially when you consider how do you make a multi-pass protein. You do it with multiple loops. So what's going to happen as the protein grows? Which end is going to get longer? Remember, this is the amino end. So as the protein gets longer, we're going to push from here. It's going to grow, its carboxyl end is going to get longer and longer, and it's going to be pushed, and the loop is going to get bigger and bigger. So that's what you see at the end of 5. I'm just going to draw the ribosome part. So we've got a big part. Here's our translocon. So as we add amino acids, the loop gets bigger and bigger. But the signal peptide, where is it? The signal peptide is down here, anchoring everything in the membrane. The signal peptide is always hydrophobic. Now, what generally happens next is the protein continues to go through, and if there are no hydrophobic sections remaining in the protein, if the signal peptide was the only hydrophobic section, then as the protein is made, it'll just keep going through. And when we get all finished, the protein will look like this. Now, how does the protein get out of the pore? It's not entirely clear, but people think that maybe the pore opens sideways or is gated sideways by the signal peptide. And remember, the signal peptide is hydrophobic. So once it gets into the lipid bilayer, it's going to stay there. But now what? Usually what happens next is an enzyme inside the lumen makes a final cut right at the end of the signal peptide, meaning that there is a sequence here which is a substrate for that enzyme. And that then cuts off the protein entirely, leaving the signal peptide behind. Now, what kind of protein did we just make? We made this kind. We made a protein that got started with that signal peptide, and then it went all the way through, and we cut off the signal peptide. And we did that, the enzyme that does that is called signal peptidase. And now the protein can fold up, the ribosome can come off, come apart into its subunits, be used again, the message can be read again or not. So this is how you get a protein which is completely inside the ER. Now what the other side of the handout shows you is how you get a transmembrane protein. The case at the top is exactly the same as what I just said, but the translocon is left off the picture to make it easier. And then the next two show you how you get transmembrane proteins with either the amino on the outside or the carboxyl on the outside. And the bottom shows you how you get a multipass protein. Now what we'll do is next time I will bring a model for this, which is a typical Moshiewicz low-tech model, which will give you some idea with using string and scissors sort of how you do this. And then we will go on and discuss once something gets into the ER, then what?